Hey everyone, welcome to season two of EMS Connect on Shift. Last year, we brought you amazing guests, some pretty edgy topics, and some stellar authors of EMS-related books. This season is going to be no different. Now, I sure hate to ask you to do anything, but you all helped this podcast grow leaps and bounds last year by simply rating and sharing our podcast. So here is our simple ask. If you haven't done so already, please rate and share this podcast on whatever platform you're currently listening to it on. And if you feel so inclined, follow the Facebook page EMS Connect On Shift Podcast and share an episode and tag us. Thank you all so much for the love and support you have shown us. Stay safe out there and let's all watch each other's sixes. Hey everyone, welcome to EMS Connect On Shift, your go-to podcast for everything EMS. Sometimes we're going to educate, sometimes we're going to review EMS articles or books, sometimes we just hang out with badass people and BS, but I'll tell you what, every time we're going to have an absolute blast. I am your host, Sean Pitts. I'm the head of education for EMS Connect. We are a top-tier EMS education organization that offers more education than you'll ever need. We have a website with hundreds of hours of education. We got online EMS refresher courses, and we even offer on-site courses. Before we jump into this episode, please take a moment to go to whatever app you're listening to this on right now and subscribe to our show, give feedback, and give our show a rating. Every rating you give truly elevates this podcast and makes it easier for others to find us. Please help us spread the word about EMS Connect and the On Shift podcast so everyone can get educated. And I have the pleasure, two wonderful physicians hanging out with me today. Dr. Dirks, would you like to introduce yourself first?
Sure. Can you hear me okay?
We can.
Awesome. So yeah, I'm an ER physician in Spokane, Washington. I work with Dr. Edminster. Super excited to have him on. He is a wealth of knowledge. He's been doing EMS stuff for a long time. So I just want to give a shout out to Joel. I'm very happy he is here. He has a ton of experience and is in the trenches with me on a regular basis. But I am still an ER physician, still barely employed probably. I'm just waiting any day to get fired for one reason or another. And I'm also a Spokane County BLS representative and medical advisor for a few different agencies here in the Spokane County region.
All right. And then we have here Dr. Joel Edminster, who is our next presenter. Joel, would you like to introduce yourself? I love these pictures, man.
That llama actually is dead. Oh yeah, it's been replaced. He died of choke. Funny part is I was supposed to take care of this llama. It belonged to Hunter Hedquist.
I know Hunter.
Yeah. And I had two of his llamas, and in the matter of the 2.5 years that I had them, they both ended up dying, which...
You did not tell how sad the story was going to be when you sent me these pictures.
But that was a great llama. He did a fantastic job. We packed a lot of elk with that one. But we have some other ones now. So we got three. That's good. RIP for that one there. And sorry, Hunter. Yeah, so ER physician. I grew up in Spokane. My dad is an ER guy and involved in EMS. So I think some people like to joke that I got my EMS roles as a what's that term that everybody in the fire department hates? It's like, no, when you get I'm drawing a blank. When you're given something that you didn't earn, like it gets passed down from
nepotism, probably.
Yeah, nepotism. Yeah.
Oh, that one. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And all my EMS. Yeah,
when you become chief because your dad is the chief.
Yeah, it was nepotism. And then I didn't earn any of it. EMS physician advisor for Spokane Fire Department, Spokane County Fire District 9. I've actually started out my EMS more involved in rural agencies. So Deer Park Transport or Volunteer Ambulance Company and Fire District 4. when I was new into EMS, and now kind of more of the urban fire EMS system. So work with Travis again. We'll both probably get fired before we voluntarily retire from our various positions at Sacred Heart. But and I am a llama lover.
This is great. I'm really sad. This,
hey, listen,
this totally threw me off guard.
You haven't camped in the backcountry until you've packed in with a llama, because you can take all of the comforts of home that you would never imagine taking on your back. You don't have to take a little small flask of whiskey. You can actually take a 6-pack of beer. You know,
that's great.
You can take 2 sleeping pads instead of no sleeping pad.
I see.
I sleep on a cot 6 miles in. It's great, man.
I love.
You don't know until you've been there.
I feel like great. I should go camping with you.
You should.
All right. So, just a reminder: launch questions. Again, we're trying to catch these guys off guard. That we have a presentation built if no one asks questions, but that's no fun. We would much rather make these guys just like shoot from the hip and answer your guys' questions. So again, either A in the questions tab on the right hand side over there. Or onlinequestions.org, and the code is 16441. We want to try this to see if it's something we like. So feel free to jump over there. So this is our Ask the Medical Director Live. I'm not sure which one of you is the person on the right or which one of you is going to take the person on the left, but these are our wonderful physicians answering questions for us. So here's our first question that was sent to us via email, and I'll let you guys just kind of jump in with whoever wants to answer. So the first question is, what do you think about pre-hospital ultrasound to aid the ALS and BLS provider to rule out ROSC or a breech delivery?
Travis, you want to start with this one?
This is sure, kind of his sure thing.
So I'll give the caveat that I am financially invested in the point of care ultrasound side of things. So I'm a big proponent, enough so that I actually put a little money into the point of care ultrasound world. There's some new companies out there brewing. And so I got excited about this. The reasoning behind my excitement is I feel like for decades, we have used the stethoscope, we do physical exam things, and this is a new tool in the toolbox that is not invasive, and it allows us to not only hear certain things, but we can actually see what's going on. It's something that I think anybody at any level, from first responder to flight medics, could easily learn. It's, in my opinion, no different than a stethoscope. It's just practice and skill. There's a lot of potential indications for point of care ultrasound, but specifically this question is addressing ROSC and a breech delivery. So some of the main indications for point of care ultrasound are like IV starts, cardiac standstill, pneumothorax, ROSC, that kind of stuff. Where I think it would be very difficult is like a breech delivery. I mean, let's be honest, if you're on scene and somebody's actively delivering precipitously, emergently, I don't think you're going to have the time, or it's not appropriate to probably pull out the ultrasound at that point. You're just going to do a quick check down below. If you see something protruding from the vaginal canal and it looks like birth is imminent, it means, you know, settle down and get ready for a show and be prepared to deliver this kid. But if you look down and do a quick check and there's no crowning, there's nothing protruding, it's just a load and go and get moving. I don't think you're going to sit down, waste time doing an ultrasound. So I don't think ultrasound during an emergency delivery is of value. But for the other indications, including intra-abdominal free fluid or, you know, pneumothorax, that kind of stuff, I think there's a lot of potential value. The big debate is going to be, yes, there's value, but is there enough potential cases where you could utilize this in the field to become not only proficient, but to become kind of a pro at it and be able to train others? So that's kind of a big debate. We're kind of doing this right now in our area, and it's going to be kind of a pilot project. I know there's some areas like in Texas and around the country who are using this every day already, and there's been some positive, some negative results, but I think it's going to be very location specific. Where I think the biggest value for point of care ultrasound is in those potentially areas where you have either long transport or in regions like ours where you have multiple hospitals in the same region, but they have different trauma levels or stroke levels, that kind of thing, different criticality. And this could potentially determine your destination. For example, if you had maybe a not such a major trauma that didn't have to go to a major trauma center, but on your quick ultrasound of the belly, because they had belly pain or a rigid or distended abdomen, you see free fluid, you would know, well, let's just divert or go away from the places we might travel by who are not trauma centers, and let's go right to the big trauma center because this is a legit trauma and there's probably blood in the belly. Likewise, a pneumothorax and that kind of stuff. Where I think this is going to be very valuable is in our ROSC patients, where you're doing active resuscitation and you're wondering when it's time to stop resuscitation. And if you could add this to your toolbox, if we put an ultrasound in the chest and we do not see heart activity, there's no movement, we don't feel pulses, there's no signs of life. I think this is kind of one of those game changers where we can potentially take away those places where you have to call in and get a physician approval to stop resuscitation. I think you can add this as a way to document, you know, there's no cardiac activity after 30 minutes of working, and so we can call it. Likewise, there's things now, people are talking about the sub pulse, where you might not be able to feel a pulse in their femoral or carotid area, but you put the ultrasound on and you actually see organized cardiac activity, which would mean that their heart is beating. It's just not beating hard enough to provide a blood pressure for you to feel a pulse. So this is where ultrasound is really kind of a hot topic, is the sub pulse, where it might determine you don't stop the resuscitation. Maybe you start fluids and pressors right away and see if you can get that blood pressure up. And potentially it might help avoid cases where you would have terminated where you should continue. I don't know. Any other thoughts on it, Joel?
Yeah, I think it's I agree. I think it's an incredible tool, diagnostic tool, and should be considered analogous to a stethoscope. Part of the trouble we have in pre-hospital care is that people don't use their damn stethoscope, even though it's easy to use and cheaper than an ultrasound. So I think there are certain people who will, and you see this a lot in the ER, even there's people who have adopted ultrasound into their practice, and there's others who have not. And I think we'll see a lot of that. It won't be a mandated thing. It'll be people who have developed the skill and are savvy with it. And I think they'll take off and thrive with it. And I think others will probably never pick it up and will not have any interest. And so I think that's kind of where it will live. I think there are certain indications that are prime for pre-hospital care. A lot of the peri-resuscitation indications that you had already addressed, but also understanding volume status, who needs more fluid, who needs a pressor. I think those are indications just by looking at inferior vena cava volumes and knowing how to utilize that information for decision making, I think is there. You know, these late, I don't ever look at anybody who's outside the first trimester with ultrasound. So a breech delivery, to me, that would not be an appropriate indication for ultrasound, but certainly a first trimester pregnancy and belly pain and hypotension, I'd want to know if there's free fluid in the abdomen, because that is indicative of a ruptured ectopic. So that's where I think, even outside the setting of trauma, looking for kind of potential causes of hypotension. So it'll be a lot like when you identify, when you're running through a PEA algorithm, what are my H's and what are my T's? I think you could probably do the same thing with a hypotensive patient and address a lot of different things. Is there volume in the belly that needs to be identified? What's the cardiac activity look like? Are they hyperdynamic on their cardiac activity? Are they slow and sloppy? Does their heart look like it's just lazy, right? I mean, then knowing how to interpret that. I don't think that you'll see even a positive FAST. If you ask our surgeon counterparts in the ER, do they want that information? They're probably going to tell you no, right? I suspect that they would say, no, I just want them transported here, and then we're going to do our usual thing. And I get that. And you get some of the same, and this might come up later, but point of care testing and troponin. Like if you ask cardiologists if they want point of care troponin, they're going to all say no, because they don't want to know about troponins that aren't related to acute coronary syndrome, right? So I think just because you can do it doesn't mean it's going to change everything. I think the power in ultrasound is knowing how to utilize it as a way to gather more information, but I think the responsibility of the people who are using it is going to be, do you apply that knowledge in a productive way?
I like it. Man, the questions are stacking up. So Dr. Dirks, I don't think we're going to need to go to your presentation. This is going to be awesome. So hope you guys are ready. Next question submitted. Why don't we see IV aspirin use in cardiac cases?
Because you can't give aspirin IV.
There you go. Look at that.
And I would add, even if we could, it'd probably be so expensive and such a pain in the ass other than just pop a few in the mouth and you can chew them. Yeah.
You can give it rectally. For those that don't get it orally, you can give it rectally, but I doubt you want to ask for that in the field. There are other antiplatelet agents that you can give, but we don't even give those in the ER, right? Like those are typically deferred to the cardiologist at the time of their intervention, or when they shoot a left heart cath and do a coronary angiogram. Sometimes they'll do some IV antiplatelet therapy. The problem with antiplatelet therapy, other than aspirin, and we even see it with something like Plavix, is that not everybody who goes to the cath lab for acute coronary syndrome ends up with a stent. We see a fair number of people who they actually are going to do better by undergoing emergent coronary artery bypass grafting. So there is a population of patients who are going to go to surgery sometime soon. And in those folks, these more potent aspirin analogs, these other potent antiplatelet therapies can actually be problematic. Even Plavix can be problematic in the post-operative patient in terms of bleeding in that surgical period. So the beauty of aspirin is that it's cheap, right? And it works. And if I developed aspirin right now, I would charge, well, I would give it away free. But if I was totally interested in retiring from medicine at an early age and walking away from it altogether, I'd sell it for the same price as Plavix, right? But it's cheap because it's been around forever and it works. And I wouldn't trade it out for something that is less effective.
Like
Dr. Or Dirks. Equally effective, right?
Makes sense.
Yeah.
Dr. Dirks, anything to add last minute?
No.
Sweet. This one I love. This is a great question. Your thoughts, both of you, on using a pediatric BBM for adults to prevent overventilation?
Too small. I mean, I'm thinking of like a neonatal one. But
yeah, child, I think is about a 500 ml capacity, yeah. Right?
I think you can easily just use the adult bag with one hand, and you're going for chest rise. I think don't make it complicated. If that's the only thing available, for some reason you can't find your adult bag, sure. But again, you're just going for chest rise. You're not going for a specific, you know, don't put it against your thigh and compress the entire bag like we used to teach.
Well, I think it comes from just this idea, like all the studies that show hyperventilation and decreased cardiac, survivability. And I know there was teachings rolling around about using, well, if we can't get providers to not overventilate with an adult BBM, is there any harm in using a child-sized BBM that decreases the capacity? I know, and I'd heard some teachings rolling around. That's why I felt like this question was pretty solid.
I get the point. So I don't know what Joel's thoughts are, but my thoughts on this is not so much the volume, it's the rate. People get too excited and they start just squeezing like crazy and they start hyperventilating a patient. It's not so much a volume problem. So it's less barotrauma and it's more rate. And so I think pediatric versus adult, there's still the potential if people are overbagging. They just have to do their nice count to six and then breath, which a lot of people won't do. I mean, even if in the ER, you watch people get intubated and then you watch nursing staff or techs or residents, even physicians bag, the overbagging is pretty prominent just because it's in the moment, it's heated, it's exciting. Joel, what are your thoughts on this? I haven't really heard of this issue before. I mean, peds versus adult.
So I've seen this before and I'm trying to Google something right now, but I don't have a good signal because I thought I remember reading an article where they actually looked at this. Pediatric, using a pediatric bag as a way to mitigate hyperventilation. And I can't, probably because my phone's a piece of junk, but I can't find it. But I think if I recall, which don't quote me on this, is that it didn't make any difference. I understand the concept. Here's the dilemma that I have. And I'm not assuming that you would want to. It's in the bag, title volumes, adult pediatric
BBM. Pulling it up here. I didn't know if this was the article.
I can't remember which one it was. It was one of these things that I probably looked at and I was like, I should look at it, but then I never did. Yeah, it goes along. So it's safer. They've done studies that say it's safer for barotrauma and things like that, but does it lead to improved outcomes? And I think that's where they said it didn't, but don't quote me on that. Here's I certainly wouldn't like toss out all my adult bags, right? Because I think there are certain instances where we intubate people and we actually do want to ventilate them rapidly, right? Like our DKA patients, aspirin overdoses, people with profound metabolic acidosis, who when you're forced to intubate, you want to intubate or you want to ventilate and match whatever their compensatory effort was, right? So if now all I've got is a pediatric BVM because I don't want to hyperventilate my post-arrest hypotensive patients, well, you're not going to be able to adequately manage your metabolic acidosis patients either. And that's kind of a complex topic that you could probably spend an hour talking about just that alone. But I think that actually has been looked at and studied, and it was a kind of a neat concept of, I'm not sure it's a neat concept, but it's kind of that same concept of, well, don't make people think about it. Just force them to do what you want by not giving them other tools, right? I think I'd much rather teach people to slow down, be intentional about what we're doing, understand that once you intubate somebody, that change in your physiology requires that you pay attention to everything, oxygen, CO2, ventilation rates, ventilation volumes, and it's going to be different for each pathologic process that you're treating, right? I'd much rather educate people on that than just say, you only get a small bag so you don't hyperventilate.
I like
if
it.
If somebody wants a good invention idea, just create a bag that's in between the peds and the adult size. There you go. One bag for everybody.
Well, there you go. Then you'll have to, since it was your idea, I think then you own like part of the royalties to that, right?
Not really.
So this next one is a really, really great question. So a little bit long, but just kind of track me for a second. As a rural EMT, there are many obstacles to obtaining ALS interventions. Bad weather, so no air medical, no availability. Do you have an opinion on BLS providers in rural areas having the potential module in ALS interventions such as epi and cardiac arrest, needle decompression, IV meds, other than saline, et cetera? I love this because I feel like this is what kind of we talked about, right, Dr. Dirks at District 10, but it'd be cool to hear your guys' opinions on this.
Well, so
you get to go first.
So essentially, I mean, this gets into that whole concept of just because we can, should we, right? And you could argue against this, or like bring up the point in the moniker that BLS saves lives, right? I'll give you epi, but there's no evidence to say that epi improves anybody's outcome in cardiac arrest, particularly adults, maybe if you give it early in peds, right? Antiarrhythmics doesn't make any difference, right? Like when we look at these things in cardiac arrest, we do all this stuff in the field, but it doesn't make a big difference. But what does make a big difference is great chest compressions and early defibrillation, okay? So they can do that, right? I think most EMTs should have IV endorsements at this point. And I think you ought to be able to place a supraglottic airway at this point, right? So those are available to EMTs, and I think that should be part of general education.
But right? At the national level, it's not.
I know,
right?
I think
at state level in Washington, we have it.
Those things, I think, are the things that will make a difference. Volume and people that need volume, right? Airway management, and it doesn't have to be advanced airway management, right? The ability to defibrillate, the ability to do good CPR. Those things matter. Needle decompression of the chest, I don't know. I haven't seen very many times in my career where I thought that somebody's needle decompression of the chest actually saved their life in the pre-hospital setting.
Can you think in a rural setting, though, tractor rollover, guy's got a pneumothorax, tension pneumothorax, we're an hour and a half away from help?
Then you should just do a finger thoracostomy.
Right.
No, it brings up a good question. But, you know, I mean, it's a limited resource, right?
Mm-hmm.
If I choose to go out in a rural space, which I love to do, I'm doing it with a risk. I know that there's a good chance that I'm not going to be transported quickly in the case of a traumatic injury, right? I'm willing to live with that. Doesn't mean we don't want to get good care to everybody that we can, but you can't always deliver the hospital to the rural community, right? Yeah. It's not always possible.
I've just always, I'll weigh in, not that I have the right to weigh in, but I've always thought that the advanced DMT scope of practice should almost be the starting point, right? Because advanced DMT at the national level is where you get IV, you get IO, IV Narcan, which of course is no big deal. You get nitroglycerin, you get those couple of drugs. But I mean, that this person asking that question, to me, that's my thought is why not? What is your opinion on the bottom of the scope of practice being what an advanced EMT can do? And then you have advanced EMT or you have paramedic, to where I feel like a lot of EMTs feel very limited in what they can do, because in Idaho, they can't do IVs. I know Oregon, you know, I don't know about Montana, you might know more about that than I do, but I know at the national level, EMTs, no IV, no IO, supraglottic airway, I think finally is part of the national curriculum for EMTs. So that's available. But
yeah, I would love to see IV endorsements at that level. I would. And I think we give people nitroglycerin and hang it around their neck and tell them if you have a twinge of chest pain, you should take a nitroglycerin. And then we tell our EMS providers, don't give anybody this medicine. You'll kill them unless you have done a 12 lead, doesn't show an inferior MI. They have an IV, all these other things. They're not on Viagra, all this BS. But we just hand it out and say, take this, take another one, take a third one and call me. Right. So there's some of that stuff that's limited that I don't think needs to be as restricted as it is. But
Dr. D, you want to weigh in?
Yeah. No, I love the concepts of rural EMS is one of my small passions professionally. So there's a couple issues I think at play here. There's a difference. One of the first ones, like I have with a couple of my agencies, is the transport time. They're near the urban center, but there's a pretty good transport time, maybe 20, 30, 40 minutes on a given day. And so there's a couple of protocols I've approved. While they're not typically allowed at the local level, I've gotten approval to train on them and let people do them, like BLS, albuterol, Duanebs, and that kind of stuff, or Epi. And it's because it's such an immediate intervention that can potentially be life-saving. I don't see a lot of risk with like giving a Duoneb and training a BLS provider how to give a Duoneb therapy. So that's one issue. The second of being in a very rural setting and wanting to do ALS stuff, there's a difference between, you know, that the tractor rollover, the one time in your career where you do an exam as a BLS first responder and you're, you know, don't hear lung sounds on one side, maybe it's winter or foggy or whatever, and you know that the ALS transport is stuck. Like you potentially can be sitting on this patient for a very long time or need to transport this patient, and you know that shit's hitting the fan and they're probably going to die without maybe an ALS intervention. Well, that's what medical control is for. You get on the phone, you talk to an ER physician, and you tell them exactly what your exam is. Maybe they walk through, hey, check this form A. What do you think the sounds are here? And they walk through it and they go, I agree with you. There's probably a pneumothorax and this guy's tanking. Okay, I'm going to walk you through doing a needle thoracostomy or a finger thoracostomy. Are you okay doing that? And you walk through it with them. And that's something I take on as my liability. And now I'm the physician on record and I'm going to walk you through it. And if you're comfortable doing it, potentially we save a life together. You broke all sorts of protocols and we explain ourselves later. And hopefully it goes well. But there's a difference between that once in a career situation and just, you know, I'm a BLS provider in a very rural setting. I want to be trained on some ALS stuff. Well, this is kind of like now you're getting the realm of TCCC, like, you know, how much training should you have at what level? And I would say if you're in a rural setting and you want the ability to do a lot more, then you need to go back to school and get the training to do a lot more, become an AEMT or a paramedic. If that's what your goal is, if you want to provide better care, then go get trained and provide better care. And granted, your rural agency will love you for probably being a higher level. They'll probably want you on all the time and you'll get lots of accolades. But that's my opinion.
I like it. Anything to follow up, Dr. Joel?
I'd like to see more people use CPAP. I think it'd be something that...
But CPAP is a national, in the national scope of practice for EMTs. It's just not at all the state levels.
Yeah.
So
how many rural agencies have CPAP and are using it and training on it? Because I think that's something that's probably underutilized that they could be doing. It
prevents innovation, right?
But I gotta agree with Travis. If you're really motivated and you want to do more, then go back to school. You can do more that way. Right? Because the procedures that we do and the little things that we do are a minutia, that's a very small minutia of what is involved in kind of understanding the critical thinking, the understanding of pathology and the misapplication. Just because you can do it, the misapplication of some of these things can be very detrimental, right? So I think knowledge is power. If you want to do more, then you need to get the education to do more.
I like Joel, I don't know how your practice has evolved over your career, but we've been doing this almost 20 years now together. And I would say when I first started, I was like any medic out there. I wanted intubations. I wanted numbers. I wanted to be aggressive. I was tubing people. I probably shouldn't tube every day. And now I think I'm much more of a critical thinker and I'm not going for numbers. And so I do what I think is right for the patient. So I'll use CPAP and BiPAP and airway meds. And my goal is to prevent intubation unless it's warranted. And so I think that's one of the big differences in what you're talking about with the procedures in the rural setting is that, like Joel said, a lot of these procedures we're doing so rarely that if you're a rural provider, you'd be doing these things once, twice in a career. So you're not going to become proficient and good at it. And potentially you're now exposing yourself and the patient to more risk than benefit.
I like it. So here's our next one, and this might have been kind of what Dr. Joel was talking about, but is it helpful for ED, MDs, for medics pull up blood vials and or iStat in the field for test use in the ED?
I think it is. I think it is, and I wish that it would get utilized more because, quite honestly, there's information that I want immediately. Right.
Do you want to explain what iStat is just for people?
So iStat, point of care testing. So it gives
me troponin and stuff you're talking about.
So right? Troponin pre-hospital or troponin. We actually got rid of our troponin iStats at Sacred Heart. So we don't use them. We just send it to the lab. But for an iStat 6, which gives me kind of some critical electrolytes, gives me a little bit of idea of whether or not somebody's anemic, right? So it gives me a hemoglobin, a potassium, a calcium. I think it gives you a sodium, a glucose. Not sure what else is on there. But it gives, so particularly a potassium, there's a lot of times when I want to know what somebody's potassium is right now. You know what I mean? So that I think it's beneficial in that regard. There's certain things that I'm going to want on a lot of sick patients that I'm not going to be able to get from a pre-hospital setting, an ABG, right? An arterial blood draw for that. I'll do that when they get there. There's going to be other tests that I think are critical, but having access to that and being able to send that down to the lab, I think is extremely beneficial. The problem is I don't think the hospital lab staff, et cetera, are quite on board with the concept, but I don't think that that is indicative of the fact that it's not valuable to have. So I would say continue to do it. I know that it's frustrating to collect it and then bring it and have it disregarded when you arrive. But I think the more that it's commonplace, I think then the more pressure we put on the labs that this is a perfectly good blood sample, that they should be accepting it. And I've argued with people when they show up that this is something that can be run. It's no different than you drawing it. Hell, I've drawn blood in the field and taken it to the hospital too. And I don't see how that's any different than me drawing blood in the ER, right? So
yeah,
I think it's very valuable.
I hear you. Yeah, I hear EMS people get kind of offended sometimes when they bring blood in and they see the ER not using it. And it's nothing against the EMS providers. Sometimes it's a policy issue. Sometimes the nursing staff didn't see it. Sometimes it's not labeled. And so we can't use it by hospital policy. And so don't be offended if you bring in blood and you don't see it used. It's nothing against you. And it's... I'm never looking for it. That's not really part of my role in the ER. My role is to see the patient and then put in orders. I'm not specifically looking for blood. And so again, just don't be offended. Collect it. I think it's a great thing that EMS people are doing.
I like it. So here's the next one. I guess we're going to test your guys' ability to educate with no preparation. It says, being a BLS department and new to capnography, having taken your waveform basics class, could you do a quick review of high and low end tidal and what we can do prior to ALS arrival? Then further, how we can assist ALS personnel. I think Dr. Dirks, we're going to let him.
This is like Joel's wheelhouse. He does our capnography lecture.
Oh, well, look at that. Hello. Yeah. Well, he was scheduled to do our capnography lecture, but he didn't make it here in time.
I was working. Asshole. So I think
to edit that out.
So I think that there's some value in the number, but I think there's also some value in waveform, right? So understanding the morphology of that waveform is as valuable as the number sometimes. So I think understanding that obstructive lung disease, things like asthma, things like COPD, will give you a waveform that is that classic shark fin appearance. What that's going to tell me is that this person's going to respond well to bronchodilator therapy. Okay. So this is an albuterol Duoneb type patient. I think the other place when we look at numbers, and I'm usually not a numbers guy, and you have to understand that this isn't as accurate as a blood gas in terms of identifying expired PCO2 or gas exchange, partial pressure CO2 in the alveoli, but it is pretty close. So when I see a low number, then see, this is a tough topic because you have to decide, is my low end tidal CO2 because I am this is a compensatory effort for a metabolic cause. So if I'm a DKA patient, or I'm an aspirin overdose patient, or I'm septic with profound lactic acidosis, and I'm breathing fast to blow off CO2, then that's going to be different than somebody who is hyperventilating because they're anxious and blowing off CO2. One of those people, my anxious blowing off CO2, tingly around my lips, tingly around my fingers, that's somebody who is a respiratory alkalosis, right? Whereas my other person with a low end tidal CO2 breathing fast is somebody who is compensating for a more serious problem, right? So you kind of have to have an understanding of acid-based disorders to be able to interpret that. The opposite is a high end tidal CO2. Am I a bad COPD patient and I can't expire and I got a shark fin appearance and my end tidal CO2 60? Well, that kind of correlates with somebody with a respiratory acidosis, right? It can also be a high number and somebody I just woke up from an overdose, right? They may be high CO2 because they're not ventilating well. So there's a lot more to it than just looking at the number and determining whether or not a high number or a low number is beneficial. But I think for your basic waveform capnography patient is getting an understanding of what normal is, right? Understanding how the morphologies can change, what that tells me about their breathing rate, their drive, and then applying that information to what their clinical picture is probably, I mean, like I said, you have to have a pretty good understanding of acid-based disorders, but I would say at a BLS level, I'd start with waveforms, understand waveforms.
So do you want to explain, I just got this up on the screen real quick. Do you want to just quickly?
Yeah. So when we look at respiratory baseline, right? Like I'm not, and remember what I'm measuring is CO2 that I'm expiring. Okay. So when I breathe in, I'm not I'm not eliminating any CO2. Air is moving in the wrong direction to be detected. Okay. So on that flat line on the bottom is when I'm in between kind of a deep breath in and ready to exhale. And then when I start to exhale, I'll have this climbing up of my CO2 level that's detected at the little, either at the ET tube or my little flared nasal cannula. And then I'll have an alveolar plateau, and that alveolar plateau is the end of my expiratory phase, right? And now where I get that measured CO2 at that beta angle is where I start to inspire. So that's where I breathe in. I get a dramatic drop in my end-tidal CO2, and you complete that respiratory cycle. So what I'm measuring is that expiratory phase right through there. Now, we know that people that air trap, they don't blow out fast, right? So that's a long, slow process, and I'll get that shark fin appearance. Takes me a while to get there. So if we go to the other diagram that you had up earlier, this is indicative of somebody who has a slow expiratory phase and more consistent with air trapping. So when I see this waveform, I think asthmatic, COPD, somebody who needs bronchodilator therapy. So I think understanding the basics of shapes and waveform is probably more valuable than understanding low or high numbers.
Sorry to jump in and interrupt, but all successful podcasts have advertisements. This podcast wouldn't exist without EMS Connect, an online self-paced CE platform for all levels of EMS providers and firefighters. Our site houses over 140 hours of nationally accredited content for all levels of EMS. Access to our site is only $7.50 a month. There are no join fees, cancellation fees, and definitely no bullshit. We also host monthly live sessions where you have the option to interact with our talented and engaging instructors. Just for listening, you will be automatically entered to win a $50 Amazon gift card, which will be drawn at the conclusion of each of our live sessions. All of our courses we offer can be easily imported to your NREMT profile with a few simple clicks. This greatly simplifies your recertification process. All of this can be yours for only $7.50 per month. In this economy, we're spending more than that on our daily coffees. But wait, there's more. Our site also offers EMT, advanced EMT, and paramedic level NREMT refresher courses that are 100% online and self-paced. For all of your training officers out there, we make your job super easy with our administrative tools such as uploading agency courses, skills tracking, participation reports, and so much more. To get a no-catch peek at the administrative tools and capabilities of EMS Connect, contact us at info@emsconnect.org. Again, info@emsconnect.org. All right, enough of the advertisements. Let's get back to this great episode.
Dr. Dirks, you want to jump in?
Yeah, it's a tool. And so I think the tool needs to be applied to the situation. If you want to know end-tidal CO2, it's something you can learn the basics of, but then you apply it to the patient you're seeing. So if you have a patient who's in no respiratory distress whatsoever, talking in complete sentences, you don't hear any wheezing, and you see an end-tidal waveform that any other day would make you think, oh, I think this is obstruction and COPD, but yet your exam doesn't clinically correlate with that, it means treat the patient. You don't have to put them on CPAP and albuterol and do different things. So this is a tool to be used appropriately as part of your recipe for patient care. And this is helping you confirm maybe your clinical decision and what you should do next. If you have a long-term smoker who's wheezing and hypoxic and you do a cool waveform and you see a shark fin, that's confirming your suspicions and you should proceed with COPD management. If you see a patient who's, you know, the same age with a bunch of swelling everywhere and in a normal end-tidal CO2 and a normal waveform, and you hear crackles in their lungs, it's probably not COPD. You just need to treat the patients, more likely CHF.
I like it. So here's the next. The next one's kind of broad. I'm not really sure what the purpose is. We're just going to put it out just the way it's written. Can you talk about recronium with hyper K? Just that broad.
Rock uronium.
Rock uronium, yeah. I'm sure they're kind of referring to the hyper-K issues with succinylcholine. So succinylcholine and rock uronium are two different classes of paralytics. Who put balloons? That's exciting. I got really excited there. That was fun. So succinylcholine is a different kind of paralytic than rock uronium. Yeah, I'm loaded. But if you give succinylcholine, one of the side effects of it, just based on its chemistry, is you can bump up the patient's potassium. So you got to be careful if you're dealing with like a dialysis patient, a crust injury, burns, that kind of stuff. If you think their potassium might be high already, probably avoid succinylcholine for you medics out there intubating. I like rock uronium. It's a different kind of class of paralytic where you're not going to see the fasciculations, the twitching you see after you give succinylcholine. You don't have to worry about potassium issues. The only kind of drawback to rock uronium is some people would argue it lasts longer. So if you want to be able to do a neurologic exam sooner, if there's like a neurologic injury or brain trauma, rock uronium will outlast succinylcholine, which is very, very short acting. It's basically just for a quick intubation. My one soapbox moment for paralytics. It's a personal pet peeve of mine when I see people redose a paralytic. In my opinion, a paralytic is a one-time thing to help you open up the vocal cord and get a tube through. After that, if you're having troubles with the patient, you're having a problem with sedation, not paralysis. I hate it when people redose a paralytic unless they're absolutely going to redose a sedative with it. But again, I hate redosing paralytics. I wish we took them out of protocols. I wish they weren't even possible. I think it's a failure of sedation at that point.
I generally agree with that, except in one category of patients is that you're asthmatic or really, really bad COPD. Those people that we intubate who are really tough to ventilate, I like to just own their ventilations. And so they get heavy, heavy, heavy sedation. And then I will reparalyze them just so that I can own that respiratory drive. They are very complex to manage intubated patients with asthma, particularly near fatal asthma. And that would be the one exception to where I like to actually paralyze those people relatively early. Because it's so hard to manage them when you've got competing respiratory drives. Yeah, but everybody else, I agree. Heavy needs to be sedated. Heavy sedation and just reparalyzing is usually a failure of appropriate sedation and analgesia.
Yep. Joel makes a good comment about, or a good point about the COPD and asthmatics, because they have rigid chests and you need to relax them. In those patients, Joel, I'll actually jump to vecuronium. We used to use it a lot in EMS. It's fallen out of favor because it's just too damn long acting. But in the asthma and COPD, that's when I'll pull out vec, which is much longer acting, and we'll redose that just because you want to completely take away all respiratory drive and paralyze them. But in the field, unless you're doing a very long transport, I think there's extremely low utility in redosing a paralytic.
So follow-up question says, does it raise the K because it pulls it out of the cells?
No.
If so, can that be counteracted by using in conjunction with albuterol to push K back into the cells?
So what Travis referred to, the fasciculations that you see with succinylcholine, remember succinylcholine is a depolarizing agent. So if you go back to what a depolarization event is, it's an action potential at the neuromuscular junction triggers the cell to depolarize, the muscle cell to depolarize, right? And what happens then is I have these sodium-gated channels that open up, sodium that is previously outside of the cell floods into the cell, and potassium that is predominantly stored inside the cell floods out of the cell. So I get this exchange of sodium and potassium that's established by the sodium potassium pump. So when I'm polarizing a cell or setting it up to fire or trigger, right, what I'm doing at that point is creating a little battery. That cell's a battery. I got lots of potassium inside, lots of sodium outside. So when I depolarize the cell, those channels open and those ions freely flow across. So if I do that to all my muscle cells with a depolarizing agent systemically, like succinylcholine, then I release a bunch of stored potassium into circulation. So when you do a blood draw on me as I'm sitting here right now, all that you're going to see in terms of my potassium is what's circulating in my blood. That's not representative of how much potassium I have in my body. Most of it is undetected. It's hiding inside cells, particularly big bulky muscle cells, right? So if I don't depolarize the cell, which is what happens with a non-depolarizing agent, I paralyze somebody without depolarizing them, there's no release of potassium. So potassium is a non-issue in that population, okay? So vecuronium, non-depolarizing agent. Rocuronium, non-depolarizing agent. It's only the depolarizing agent, succinylcholine, that releases potassium. That's how it works. It depolarizes all the cells, then they don't polarize again, okay? So I don't run into that same problem with rocuronium that I get with succinylcholine. So potassium is a non-issue for rocuronium.
I love it.
That was the best explanation of that I've ever heard.
Well, it is the Joel Edminster.
Llama taught me that.
Stop. So here's the next one. I love this. I think this is aimed at Travis. And I promise you, Travis, I did not put this in here. It just says backboards, question mark.
Well, so, that's because I put that one in there.
It's been liked three times. People have moved it to the start of the conversation.
That's funny. That was actually me. I just typed that in.
Of course you did. I heard you're a big, big proponent of standing takedowns. So would you like to have this conversation?
You cut to the core of me, Baxter. I'm not a fan of standing takedowns. So no, I wanted to pick Joel's brain about where he's at with teaching like Spokane Fire and his agencies about backboards and just where he's at in his career of where should we be?
So I think that there is a strong move to get people off of backboards, which I think is totally appropriate. A prolonged time on a backboard we know is bad. There's really no point in putting a trauma patient who has penetrating trauma and no neurologic deficit, there's no point in putting them on a backboard, right? So mechanism of injury, I think, is important to take into consideration. That being said, there are some patients, particularly our bad blunt trauma patients, where the most efficient and safest way to transport them is probably by getting them on a backboard and a C collar and maintaining spinal motion restriction for transport, right? Now, there's a certain population of patients where we know if you self-extricate from a bad accident or you can get out and lay down on a gurney, then I can maintain spinal motion restriction on that patient by just telling them, sit still, don't move, right? But what about my obtunded patient in a terrible accident, ejected from a vehicle? There's a serious mechanism of injury there. And I don't think that just putting them on a tarp, throwing them on a gurney and transporting and somebody who's potentially combative, can't be redirected, can't cooperate, that the best way to transport that person is probably on a backboard. And then when we get them, we take them off the backboard, right? So I think you have to apply, I think this kind of like we use them or we don't use them. There's no black and white there. I think there's certain patient populations where they need to be secured during transport. And then I think there's other populations where I just need to be careful in transport. And then there's others where I think that laying this guy down flat with penetrating trauma to the chest on a backboard in a C collar is actually detrimental and is the absolute wrong thing to do and probably is going to be more harm than good. So I think it really takes some consideration of what am I dealing with? What's the mechanism of injury? I wouldn't throw them out altogether at all. When I'm not going to use it and I'm worried about a spine, it's kind of a nonverbal communication that this has a significant mechanism and we should be careful with that person, right? You show up on a C collar and a backboard, and I'm going to press on your neck and your back before I remove it. So some of this has to be that we ensure that there's communication there about, hey, this is somebody who had a mechanism of injury. They're in spinal motion restriction. So they still need to be log rolled appropriately. They need to be examined appropriately. That backboard is kind of a cue to the receiving team to do that. So when that's absent, I think that communication piece of here's the mechanism of injury. They were complaining of back pain. They're still in spinal motion restriction. That needs to take place.
I love that. Dr. D.
Yeah, he nailed it. I mean, this is, again, another tool in our toolbox, and you need to use it appropriately at the right time. If you feel like you're in a region where some of your protocols may be outdated, where you know that maybe other areas are using backboards less for very specific indications, like Joel mentioned, I definitely recommend you go check out the NAEMSP, the National Association of EMS Physicians, their website, and go to their position statements, specifically look for spinal motion restriction, and then give it to your local counselor, whatever, if you want to do any protocol changes, because it says just what Joel went through. There's specific times when you should use a rigid backboard and other times when you don't have to. And we still do a lot of old school stuff just based on dogma, and it's how we've always done it, right? That's that horrible statement you hear in the fire department and EMS world is, this is how we've always done it. And that at some point becomes a little bit ridiculous. Like, we used to bloodlet people as well to get the bad spirits out, but that's how they always did it. So we need to be open to change, but at the same time, be mindful of common sense. And like Joel mentioned, if you have a specific case where it's an obtunded or agitated patient thrown from a vehicle, by all means, put them on a backboard. You're not only protecting their spine potentially, but also protecting yourself during transport. Use your webbing. You know, it's kind of a small restraint. And let us then deal with it when they get to the ER. We may have to sedate them or whatever, intubate them, and then get them off the backboard. So it's a useful tool to be used appropriately. And I don't want people to confuse some of my stances on backboards as I want to get rid of them altogether. I know I did a talk about the death of the backboard once, and I was you know, pushing the limits of things. But I think that protocols are stuff that needs to change with the times, change according to the science behind it. And the science behind the backboard and the overutilization of it has actually been around for like 13, 14 years now, which is crazy to think that 14 years have gone by since the science came out and people still put everybody on backboards, which is insane to me. So definitely check out the NAEMSP position statement on spinal motion restriction if you're having any questions about backboards.
I like it. Here's the next one. Any preference for amiodarone versus lidocaine in out-of-hospital cardiac arrest and why?
Joel, do you have a preference? I don't. Because the reality is, like Joel mentioned earlier, for out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, there's only two things that matter, two things that lead to the person walking out of the hospital and hugging their loved ones again. And Joel mentioned them. Good quality compressions right away and early defib. Those are the only two things that have any proven science behind them to have the consistent benefit. Everything else we do, epinephrine, atropine, you name it, amiodarone, lidocaine, isn't associated with 30-day out of hospital, walk away, hug your family, cardiac arrest. Okay. We get a lot of people back who, you know, have a heartbeat but no brain. And so you got to be careful when you read the literature about, you know, resuscitation rates and the percentage of ROSC in patients and, you know, whether amio or lidocaine was better. And we read that and we go, oh, this one says amio was better this year. But is that saying the person walked out of the hospital, or does it say we got their heartbeat to beat again and their brain was fried and dead and we had to pull the plug 2 weeks later? So you got to read into these things with a little bit of common sense. Where I'm interested is when you see good neurologic outcome follow-up, then I'll pay attention. But getting a heartbeat back, we can get a heartbeat back on nearly anybody. If we resuscitate long enough and throw enough epinephrine at them, we'll probably get a heartbeat back, but that doesn't mean we got a brain. And so the last I saw, lidocaine versus amio, it seems like every 3 years it changes as to which one's better.
I had this old car. I can't even remember why. I don't even remember the guy. I can remember his face. This old cardiologist when I was in training back in Cleveland. And he swore that if it was VTAC from ischemia, lidocaine was better. If it was VTAC from anything else, amiodarone was better. And there is absolutely no science behind that. But for some reason, that stuck. And then I know people have strong feelings one way or another. Casey Austin, one of my favorite paramedics for Spokane Fire Department. If I gave that guy 10 choices between amiodarone and lidocaine, he would choose lidocaine every single time. And we've had this conversation. There's no evidence, right? But people tend to like one over the other. The ALPS trial, which was recently done in Seattle, looked at this very same thing and looked at outcomes, and there's no benefit. Actually, they did a subgroup analysis, which you always got to be careful about subgroup analysis because it's always underpowered. The only thing a subgroup analysis can ever tell you out of a study is that we should study this again, right? Which is great. And that's a very honest analysis of data. But the ALPS trial looked at this and they said that there's no difference essentially. And the only time that they could find a difference is if it was administered through an IV, then there was a benefit to antiarrhythmics over placebo, but only when it was administered through an IV. So anything given through an IO of any type had no benefit. So that brings up an interesting concept of maybe it's not the drugs that we're delivering, but how we are delivering them. And I think a lot of the older evidence about epinephrine, you have to be honest and you have to say, hey, listen, what did we used to do when we resuscitated, when all those publications about epinephrine were out? We would do compressions and then we would stop and we would ventilate and then we would start chest compressions again, right? So maybe it was how we resuscitated that led to ineffective drugs, right? So I think that's part of this is it just continuously needs to be studied and we need to tweak it and find out what are the variables that actually make a difference. Who knows? Maybe lidocaine is 10 times better than amiodarone, but only in a small subset of patients and only when delivered through an antecubital IV. Who the hell knows, right? We got to look at that information. But right now there's nothing there that says that one is superior to the other.
I like it.
And a lot of evidence says that neither is superior to saline. Really, it doesn't matter. The question really should be amiodarone, lidocaine, or saline. Which one do you prefer?
All right, here's our next question. So there was a study that came out that was comparing endotracheal intubation and supraglottic airways during cardiac arrest. And there used to be this conversation of like, so which one's better? Should we intubate or should we do SGA? I don't know if you're familiar with the study. I know Dr. Dirks is because I asked him this question once before, but what are your thoughts? I mean, obviously, if you're only an EMT, then we're talking about then just do the SGA. But you got an SGA in place, paramedic arrives. Does he pull the SGA and drop the ET tube? Does he leave it in place? Is there any opinion whether you should leave one, go for the other? Is one better? What are we looking at? Dr. Joel, you're going to go first.
So I've never seen anybody go to the ICU with a supraglottic airway in, right? So it just doesn't happen. So eventually this thing's going to get switched out for a more stable, secure, closed airway circuit, right? Is essentially what we're looking for, closed airway circuit. My thought is if I can do the intubation without harm, then I'd rather see that because that's going to be the long-term solution. If I can't do it without causing harm, then I should stick with the supraglottic, right? I think when we look at a lot of these studies, there's a lot of evidence out there that suggests that people who get advanced airway, endotracheal intubation in the pre-hospital setting have worse outcomes. I have a hard time believing that's because they got an ET tube. What I do think is that it probably was the mismanagement of the ET tube while it was being placed. Were they appropriately oxygenated? Were they appropriately ventilated? Did they have the right drugs? Was it a distraction to the rest of the resuscitation effort? If I can eliminate those variables, then I can't help but believe that the most secure, stable airway is better, right? Now, whether or not that happens, it's hard for me to say, right? So if I can't guarantee those things, then I should do the least invasive, least threatening, which in that circumstance would be a supraglottic airway. I do tell people to exchange those out if they have an opportunity to do it, 10-minute timer locally, right, for cardiac, presumed cardiac causes for arrest. we do locally, we do a 10-minute timer essentially. So we kind of clean things up, button everybody up, make sure that I got a 12 lead EKG, make sure that if I'm going to transport and there's a risk of rearrest, we have a mechanical CPR device for transport, right? And during that time, if I have somebody who is good at endotracheal intubation and they want to replace the eye gel with an ET tube, then I support it. In fact, I just recertified one of the city fire medics who had something like 32 intubations in his 3-year cycle. That's a lot of intubations. It's not like I'm getting red flags coming across once a week about this guy intubating people inappropriately. They're all appropriate intubations. They're out there and available. Turns out he likes to intubate everybody who's a cardiac arrest. Even if they had a supraglottic, he pulls it and replaces it. And I'm not getting like tons of phone calls from people saying that this guy's reckless. So I trust him. I think he's probably better at intubating now because he does 32 in a 3-year cycle than the person who's barely scraping by to get 6.
I like it. Dr. D?
Yeah, Joel nailed it. It's not the tube that's causing any bad outcomes. It's, you know, the delay in, you know, them doing CPR, time off the chest while getting the tube. It's that kind of stuff. I mean, like he said, nobody goes to the ICU with a supraglottic. So the endotracheal tube is like the definitive airway control of that closed circuit. And so I don't think anybody should ever look at this data and say, oh, well, they're saying endotracheal tubes are worse than supraglottics. That, again, use common sense. That can't be true. It has to be something else associated with it. And what we've all know from the past is that, you know, 10 years ago, if you would have looked at the time off the chest spent to intubate, the paramedic intubating would have estimated it took 30 seconds. But then the reality was the numbers showed that it actually took like a minute and a half. And they were off the chest, screwing around, trying to get the tube down, which wasn't the priority at the time. And so it's going to be something like that. That's going to be the underlying factor associated with any worse outcome. And so if you're doing quality compressions and shocking and doing what you should do for a resuscitation, and you have the time and resources and staff to do the intubation successfully and properly with good oxygenation, absolutely, I'd say go for the tube every time. If you don't have all those resources and time, you don't even have to do the supraglottic. You can keep doing quality compressions and defibrillating. That's the priority. But if you have the time and the staff, sure, throw down a supraglottic. If you're the paramedic who comes on scene and you want a definitive airway, because the supraglottic isn't going to prevent, it's not that closed circuit, it's not going to prevent true regurgitation or aspiration, then yeah, put down the endotracheal tube. Just be aware, if you pull out a supraglottic, there is a potential you're going to have a little bit of edema. There might be a little bit of irritation or bleeding, but just plan on it. It's fine. But yes, we replace these tubes in the ER every time.
I like it. So here's our next question. Two-part question, and I'm going to let Joel start with this one because I know from an email a couple weeks ago, you have some information on the whole shock and do we give fluids or what's a blood pressure. So you have a septic shock patient and you want to give some fluids. What type of fluids? How much should I give? What's the evidence say about septic shock with just normal saline? And then the flip side is you got a major hemorrhage shock patient. They're showing signs of hypotension. All you have is that isotonic solution. What's your thoughts? What's the standard? Go from there.
So in general, I think it was Lancet published a study that said that there was a lower incidence of renal failure or acute kidney injury in patients that received large volume resuscitation of lactated ringers compared to normal saline. So since that study, I believe it was Lancet, I personally have changed to more, I think that might be a review on it or an opinion piece on it. I've changed predominantly to resuscitation with lactated ringers, which is a balanced solution. So I know that if I give people a ton of normal saline, I'm actually going to precipitate some acidosis. I'm going to create some acidosis there. So by using a balanced crystalloid solution, I get less acidosis. Now, the difference between normal saline and lactated ringers is that lactated ringers is more hypoosmolar. And so you can get a little bit more of shift of fluid out in than you would get with normal saline, which is more isotonic. So it has a similar salt concentration, essentially, is kind of your physiologic milieu. So the only time that I don't like to use it is really in the setting of head injury, because I don't want to contribute to cerebral edema. So isotonic fluids, remember, some of the treatment for increased intracerebral pressure is hypertonic saline. I want to pull fluid out. I want to suck some of that edema out, right? So if I'm using a hypoosmolar solution like lactated ringers, I could make head injury victims, so stroke victims, head bleed, anybody with concerns for ICP, I tend to favor saline. But all other patients, I've pretty much switched over to lactated ringers. If it's a septic patient, kind of the target is 30 cc's per kilo, right? Because most of these people are dry, and remember, they have a distributive shock. So they don't have good vascular tone. Their vessels are leaky. They tend to need the volume. They tend to be volume down. So they get large volume resuscitation. Okay. Now, some of those patients, I think you can probably, some of them actually got to be a little bit more careful, and I may start pressors early on them, but I'm definitely going to load them first. I'm going to fill the tank, so to speak. This is one of those areas where I think point of care ultrasound is extremely beneficial, and to assess IVC size, inferior vena cava size, in terms of to kind of determine whether or not the person's tank, quote, is full, right? So for those folks, I'll generally give large volumes of crystalloid, usually in the form of lactated ringers, and then I'll start pressors, okay? So that is a distributive shock patient. They need volume, okay? They need vascular tone. My hypovolemic hemorrhagic shock from a trauma patient is a very different beast, okay? That person needs volume also, but I know that the volume they need is colloid volume, right? And when I look at my things that create worsening outcomes and trauma for resuscitation, it's the fatal triad: hypothermia, acidosis, and coagulopathy. And by large crystalloid resuscitation in that population, I'm doing all those things. As much as I want to warm that saline, I'm not going to warm it to body temp, and I'm going to send it through a tiny little tube that's at room air. So regardless, even if I had it at body temp, it's not going to be there when it hits you. So I'm going to make you acidotic. Remember, we talked about saline in and of itself, and even a hypotonic or a balanced solution is probably going to make you acidotic. The fact that you're under perfused is going to make you acidotic at baseline. And then I'm going to be dilutional in terms of diluting out clotting factors. Whereas if I start giving people whole blood, right, or blood products, colloid, then I can warm it. I can give you clotting factors. I can do all the things that I need to do to resuscitate you appropriately, right? So I want those people to get blood as soon as possible. Now, if I have to give them a liter of crystalloid, that's fine. Okay. If I have to give them a liter and a half, that's probably fine. But I really don't like to chase numbers in that population as much as I like to chase a clinical exam. So really, I should be resuscitating my penetrating trauma, hemorrhagic shock patient to a radial pulse and a mental status. And as long as you're talking to me and I can feel a radial pulse, I'm happy. And I'm going to allow for some permissive hypotension, right? So if I got a guy who got shot who's our age, which most of these trauma patients are, they get shot, they're young, right? They got strong hearts. They got an ability to compensate. I can have a blood pressure of 80, right? I can have a blood pressure of 80. I'm going to compensate. I'm going to squeeze down. I'm going to kick my heart rate up, and I'm going to be able to perfuse vital organs with a blood pressure of 80, okay? Now, if I try and get that to 90, or I try and make that greater than 100 because that's the number that looks good, then I'm going to start giving a bunch of crystalloid, which is going to do all the things that I don't want in that patient. It's going to make them cold. It's going to make them acidotic, and it's going to dilute them, make them coagulopathic. So I'm not helping them. Okay. Now, if they start to lose their mental status, I start to lose a radial pulse, then I got to give volume. And if that's the volume I have, you got to give it, and we'll fix it when you get them to us, right? So that's my thought. You got to understand, what is the underlying pathologic process? Am I neuro injury? Am I septic shock, distributive shock? Am I hemorrhagic shock? Understand what am I treating, and then apply resuscitation in the appropriate manner for each of those.
I love that. Dr. Dirks.
Man, he's a smart guy. Jeez.
We should have him on more often.
Yeah, like he's got the science behind it.
I know.
So,
I'm blushing.
For the geeks out there. Yeah. To he's geek blushing. Out, so for the people who wonder what the big difference is, if you give too much saline, so if you give too much saline, it's sodium chloride. Okay, you're going to jack up their chloride. What then happens in the cell? Hey, nice. What happens in the cell is the chloride goes up. Bicarbonate has to help buffer things. You get chloride shift. You lose bicarbonate buffering capability, which then leads to acidosis. So typically I'll tell people, you know, after 2 liters of normal saline, stop and switch to LR, because it is that balanced fluid resuscitation. The only other thing I would add is normal saline, LR, neither of them can carry oxygen. So in a trauma patient who's lost blood, your goal should be getting blood. But yeah, Joel is super smart. He's great.
Yeah, he's great.
He's a good guy.
He's all right. Another one popped in here. Oh man, this is going to be good. If you could change one current thing about EMS, what would it be? Whether it's patient care related, EMS operations, etc. So I'm going to give you 30 seconds. I'm going to set a timer.
No, I don't need 30 seconds. I know exactly what I'd change.
Let's hear it. Go for it.
Attitudes.
Attitudes of our patients?
No, of our providers. Okay. Medic versus medic. Medic versus BLS. BLS versus medic. I'm tired of the shit. Okay. People come on scene and you have mutual aid. You have multiple agencies responding. You have maybe a fire department showing up and then the transport department showing up. And you get this medic to medic crap. You get BLS getting treated like crap by the medic. If we could all just act a little more professional on scene, that would be greatly appreciated from my point of view, because it's really obnoxious to me as a medical advisor to have to waste my effing time dealing with personalities on scene. When if you just went up to both of these providers and said, okay, change of plans, the patient in front of you is your mother, proceed. You know, inevitably one of those providers would change what they're doing, would totally change their treatment profile, would totally change letting the patient sign out, you know, against medical advice, would forget the whole release and walk away. They'd put so much more care and time into it, it would be astounding. So I would change personalities on scene. I really hope that as things progress, I know healthcare sucks right now. I know taking care of patients can suck. I know some patients themselves really suck. I get it. The world is a little sucky right now and we're all having to deal with it. But if you can just check your ego at the door, check your attitude at the door and walk into the scene knowing that you're the professional who's showing up to care for another human being or their family and just get along with people and be a pro and be able to talk through things and not let your ego get in the way, that would be fantastic. I would like that.
Dr. Joel.
100% agree.
I love it.
100% agree. Like half the things I get that are like clinical complaints that I review, it turns out it's nothing clinical at all. It's dressed up in a cloak of clinical complaint, but really it's a personality conflict. And it is a total waste of time to chase down charts, review charts, just to find out it was like, well, I don't like that person and they pissed me off 3 weeks ago and this is my chance to get them. Like it pisses me off. Along those same lines, just that kind of apathy. I hate nothing more than apathy. And sometimes I see apathy and I think it leads to disorder. The concept of entropy, right? If you just leave shit alone, it goes to disorder, right? You don't mow your lawn, it goes to disorder, right? If you don't intervene, if you don't make an effort to clean your house, all of a sudden, it turns into a shithole, you know, like there's crap everywhere. Like things tend to move to disorder, right? That's entropy. Okay. So unless you're doing something every day to bring order, to clean things up, to make things better, to give a shit on the job, things will go to entropy, right? So you have to have this vested effort to do something positive, to do something to bring order. Because otherwise, if we just show up, do our job and don't do anything else, and you're not vested in the outcome, then things are going to fall apart. You're going to hate your job. You're not going to find the instrument that you needed when you wanted it, right? Like, these are the things that you have to fight against every single day. And I like to see more of that.
Joel, I don't know how you are when you return home after shift, but I have to remind my kids sometimes, because I'll come home, you know, after a bad shift and we'll have dinner, and I'm just in a the world needs to burn kind of mood, where I just hate everybody. And I think patience and people act so horrible, and, you know, drugs and violence and abuse. And what I have to remind my children and other people I talk to, I mean, even coming to work, talking to Sean and people, you know, when I'm off shift, I might complain and whine about stuff, and I might have nothing good to say about other humans. But I want everybody to know that when you're on shift, when I'm in the ER, when you're on scene with that patient, you have to check all that stuff outside and leave it outside, because when you walk through the door, you have a duty and a job you're being paid to do. And nowhere in that job description is it going to say, treat the person in front of you like shit, no matter if they're a homeless, meth addict, whatever. Even the prisoner, you know, we have prisoners come in, and these are convicted murderers, and they come in for one reason or another, but your duty is to be their care provider, whether that's, you know, something you're excited about or not, but you still have to show up and do your job. And part of that is not being a total prick when you're in the room. So, you know, excuse the language, sorry if I'm offending people, but this is something I find to be really dangerous, because I'm not sure if Joel agrees, but I think the medical system is on a decline. And I think the attitudes of both EMS, physicians, nursing staff, techs, everybody, I think we need to do a real big gut check of, you know, we chose this job, and it's okay if off shift we have dark humor, we complain, we whine, but on the job, in the ER, in the ambulance, on scene, you need to be a pro. You need to turn it on. And if it means, you know, you have to put on a show and act like it, fine. That is fine if you have to act like a pro on scene, if you're not in the mood right then, because it's just going to save your butt, mine, and help the patient.
I like it.
I know that feeling.
Yeah.
That's so good.
Yeah.
So here's the next one. Pre-oxygenation before the administration of Narcan for opioid overdoses as a BLS versus ALS provider. And when would a provider opt for Narcan immediately before pre-oxygenating, if ever?
It's both as soon as you can. I mean, do the first thing you can. If you have two providers showing up and one can start oxygen while one's getting Narcan, great. You're going to do them as fast as you can either way. If you have a patient who's not adequately breathing, you need to do the first thing first. You need to breathe for them, give them oxygen. I wouldn't mess around for a long time finding the Narcan, getting it ready if the patient's not breathing. So breathe for them first while then you get the Narcan. That would be, I guess, my blunt answer, but usually we're trying to kind of do things at the same time if you can.
Yeah, this is something you do in parallel, not in series. And I would just remind folks that the goal of Narcan is to reverse respiratory depression, not to wake people up. And that if you really want, if you want the opportunity at making a difference for that individual, you're more likely. And I'm not saying that everybody, if we do it the right way, is going to like seek help and get treatment and not use fentanyl anymore. But I promise you, if I give them enough just to wake them up and precipitate withdrawal, their focus is not on, this was a terrible thing that happened, I need to change my life. Their focus is, I got to get not sick again. And guess what they're going to do? They're going to go find more fentanyl. So the goal here is to restore respiratory drive, not to precipitate withdrawal, and then have a conversation about what can we do to get you out of this. You just had a life-threatening event. Can we help you? Right.
Yeah, I think this goes back to the very last thing when we, you know, I was on a rant about behaviors. If you see another provider using what I call punitive Narcan, like a high dose Narcan when they could have just done a smaller dose, I think that is a gut check moment of you need to either talk to that provider or let a superior or supervisor know that, like, you know, maybe this provider needs, I don't know, counseling. If there's burnout going on, maybe somebody needs to ask him, you know, what was your goal in giving the patient 2 milligrams of IV Narcan when you, you know, had a vial and you could have given 0.4? What was your goal here? Because punitive Narcan, I think, is one of the fastest or easiest signs of burnout in our current environment. And I don't see it as much as I used to. I used to see it a lot, and it really scared me because I think it's a mean thing to do.
All right, here's our next one. You are Cruz, right? And this is more from your medical advisor standpoint. So my Cruz are working a cardiac arrest on a pediatric patient. We're trying to decide whether or not we want to run this cardiac arrest on scene and quote unquote stay in play, or because it's a pediatric cardiac arrest, should we be loading this patient and transporting them while chest compressions are being performed?
Well, there's clear science on that. If you want a good outcome, you stay and you resuscitate. And I think that there is, if you want to relieve yourself of the burden of doing your job, then you transport. But if you want a good outcome, you stay and play and you get pulses. And if you look at, and locally we've moved to, and I don't have any money in the game. I'm not getting paid by Hantevi. But Hantevi really does emphasize the fact that we shouldn't be treating pediatric out-of-hospital cardiac arrest any different than we treat adult out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. And when you really look at the drugs and the treatments and the strategies, they're very, very similar, right? Like in our mind, we have it set up that these are two very different things. And in fact, they're not. There are very small differences, and there's ways and strategies that you can take those differences and make them less of a barrier to treatment. So locally we use the Hantevi system, and we encourage people to stay, work until you get pulses back. Now there are some circumstances with kids that you can run into trouble, like SIDS patients, right? If you don't transport, you could get pissed off parents, angry parents, or you could get bystanders who want to intervene. And circumstances where I think that there's a safety issue for providers, then I would say get them out of that situation. When you get an 85-year-old that dies in the home, who had comorbidities, that's kind of an easy thing to wrap your head around, right? That's what happens to elderly people with comorbidities. When you get that with a kid who's 6 months old or 3 years old, that's a really hard thing to wrap your head around. And there's a lot of resources in the hospital available for grieving parents that they don't have in the pre-hospital setting. But I think if you want to give that kid the best outcome possible, then you stay until you get pulses back.
Great. Well, that is just checking. Let's see here. One more question just popped up. When to go for a Miller blade over a Mac? I find most paramedics at our company prefer Macs. Is it just personal preference?
I think this goes back to the lidocaine versus amio. Why do some providers always use lido versus some always use amio? They've maybe had good success with one over the other. A lot of times this is just what you've trained on, what you're comfortable with. I like Max because that's what I always used. I got comfortable and I got successful. So people they default to what they're successful and they're comfortable with. And that's no different for Max versus Millers. And I would never tell a person you can't use a Miller on this one versus a Mac. Again, it's whatever's going to be successful. And if you're always successful with a Miller and you suck up every time you use a Mac, I don't care what you use. It's fine.
Dr. E,
why don't you have video laryngoscopes?
Because they're expensive.
All right.
That would be my
not story. Everyone has all kinds of money.
Get a video. Yeah.
Just like you guys and your point of care ultrasound. Jeez, not everyone's got just money laying around.
I think I agree. It's what you're adept with, but I think it does behoove you to be skilled in all of them. If you find that you don't operate a Miller blade well, or you struggle with it, then I think that's really what your focus should be on when you're training. Because there are certain times when you're going to find that that's a better instrument. Small kids tend to be a little bit easier with a Miller, in my opinion. Anterior airways tend to be a little bit easier with a Miller blade. Everything else, I would prefer a Mac blade, hands down.
Yeah, he makes a good point. I think if you're out there and you are a crew that does intubations and you have ALS care and you don't have a video option yet, I think that's something to strongly consider putting the money into. Personally, I have no money in it. I like the McGrath. I think it's extremely portable, very usable, very simple. I do recommend, so personally, like I go to a video Mac every time. But I do try to, throughout the year, if I get a patient who I think is going to be an extremely easy intubation, I'll intentionally push myself to do something I haven't done in a while, maybe a bougie pass or a Mac blade, or I'll use the video laryngoscope without the video, and then you can always turn it on. And so I think, like Joel said, testing yourself, pushing yourself to stay up to date and be able to use different modalities is a very handy thing in case you're ever caught or paint yourself into a corner.
Sweet. Next question that popped up is, have you seen a return of consciousness from a Lucas device? Now, what I'm going to assume is we're not talking about return of spontaneous circulation. I know there's some studies or articles that say the person actually, like while the Lucas is going, is opening their eyes, looking around. And then if you're pausing the Lucas device, that's going away. So maybe now being a great time, even if your 30-second opinion on, when you guys are all about video laryngoscopes and all this expensive crap. So how about the wonderful $20,000 automatic CPR device?
I've seen it with people doing conventional CPR too. You do chest compressions, you restore perfusion to the brain. You stop chest compressions, they lose perfusion in the brain. I don't think it has to do with a mechanical CPR device. I just think that they're getting perfusion. And some people you'll see that.
Dr. D? Dr. D,
he
Dr.
Nailed
D.
It. Just I mean, the only difference between an automated compression device and a human is that the automated one can go for a long time and do the same thing consistently. There should be no difference really in quality of compressions. If you're on the chest as a human pushing on the chest, I would hope that you're perfusing the brain and getting good pulses, no different than a Lucas. Now, a human can't really go beyond the 2-minute mark, and I wouldn't recommend it. But yeah, if you put compressions on a patient, I would expect if they're going to wake up, they're going to wake up regardless if it's a machine or a human.
Hey, thanks for checking out another episode of EMS Connect on Shift. Please subscribe, review, and rate our podcast on your favorite platforms. Those ratings really help our podcast grow and reach new listeners. Also, make sure to like and follow our social media sites by searching EMS Connect on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. Thanks for getting educated with EMS Connect.